Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Leslie Gore. Gore is a former 60s teen idol best known for her classic hit songs, It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To, and You Don't Own Me. She also appeared on numerous TV sitcoms, including The Donna Reed Show and in 1998, an episode of Murphy Brown. Last year, she released her first album in 30 years entitled Ever Since and has just returned from a successful solo tour of the West Coast. I'm speaking to Leslie Gore from her home in New York. Leslie, welcome to Out of Bounds. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tish.
Listen, I've often wondered, when one begins their career so young, did you come from a family that actually encouraged you to begin performing at such a young age, or was this all your idea?
You know, I came from a family that didn't necessarily encourage it, but they didn't discourage it. They really weren't quite sure what it was, but they knew I was having fun at it, and very often it created fun for other people. So they saw the effects it had on people, and I think they sort of, it kind of fell under my spell when that would happen, because I would enjoy making music so much. So I think it was a little of both.
Oh, that's interesting. And I know you were discovered in 1964 at the age of 16, and you immediately began working with Quincy Jones.
That's right.
Now, how did a teenager from New Jersey meet Quincy Jones? Tell us the story.
I surely will. From the time I was a teenager, I really did want to sing, probably from the time I was before a teenager. And I made the determination one summer that I was going to take vocal lessons. And I found a vocal coach in New York. I was living in New Jersey at the time over the George Washington Bridge, which was really a short bus ride and a short subway ride to the city. So I found a vocal coach, and I began studying, with my parents knowing, of course. And I started studying with this gentleman, and we did some piano voice demos during one of my sessions. And those demos got to Quincy Jones through Irving Green, who was the president of Mercury Records. And the idea there basically was they were looking for teenagers to record with because they had a wonderful array of artists like Brooke Benton and Dinah Washington and some wonderful great so many of the great jazz greats. But they were looking to try to get into the youth market. So Quincy was actually looking for a teenager who could sing, so that when my tapes came across his desk, he recognized the possibility that we could work together and called me.
And how did you end up recording It's My Party? Did they just present you that?
Well, Quincy went ahead, as a good producer will, and called all of the publishers that existed in New York and in L.A., and he began to gather songs that he thought were credible for us to record, and that's how we found It's My Party.
That's interesting. Now, after all your success, which obviously came really young, you decided to go to college and you went to Sarah Lawrence. Now, did you decide that pursuing just a music career was not going to be enough for you? How did you decide to go to college amid all this?
You know, it was what I had intended to do, and I just decided not to interrupt the flow. I very early on understood that it was a fickle business, and I also, knowing myself, I didn't think that if I didn't go on to college, I was afraid I would never go to college. So I just, it was always in my plan to continue to go to college, and I just didn't change the plan.
Well, what did you study while you were there?
English and American Literature, and I minored in theater.
Wow, that's fascinating. I bet a lot of people don't know that about you. Were you received well in college, or were people sort of scared of you like they are with famous people, you know?
Well, you know, actually, they weren't so much scared of me. I think the administration and the teachers thought I was there more as a PR a twist rather than I seriously wanted to be there. And I think that the students at that time, I would have been better off if I had been a folk singer than a pop singer. Joan Baez was much more honored at Sarah Lawrence than a girls' group sound. So, I took my lumps.
But, you know, I'm fascinated by the fact that one of your most famous songs, You Don't Own Me, and it still resonates after 40 years. And let's
sure
listen
does.
To a bit of it. You recorded a new version on your latest CD. Let's listen to a bit of it.
Sure.
You don't don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. You don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'll never stay.
Now tell us about this song. That is one of the most serious songs that a teenager could have ever sung.
Well, but think about it. You're 16 or 17 years old. You get an opportunity to stand up on a stage, shake your finger at people, and say, "Don't tell me what to do." Now, isn't this something that every kid has wanted to say somewhere down the line?
Absolutely.
And if not every adult, I mean, that just seemed like a no-brainer to me. I didn't even think about it as being a feminist song. I really thought about it as being a humanist song. I figured anybody could stand up there and do that. But I got that opportunity. And for me, that was great. I like to think of, and I've used this comparison before, but maybe sometimes it makes sense. It's My Party was a good song and a great record.
Mm-hmm.
You Don't Own Me was a great song and a great record. So what happened is it lends itself to other versions. It also takes on nuances every time you sing it. It's imbued with something else.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sign of a great song.
Yeah, it is. And I was going to ask you, has the meaning of that song changed for you through the years? It
absolutely
must have. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Every time I sing it, you know, it's never been sung twice the same way. I do it in every show I perform, and it's a song that just keeps growing with me and beyond me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have other people recorded it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There have been a number of versions. Back in the 60s, shortly after I recorded it, the Dusty Springfield covered it almost immediately.
Mm.
And then there have been some interesting versions, like Joan Jett's version. She did a version back in, the late 80s, early 90s, which is pretty good.
Hmm. You have openly discussed that you discovered in your 20s that you were a lesbian. Now, how did you deal with that? You had sort of a clean-cut, almost square image.
Well, it wasn't easy, I'll tell you that. As I tried to sort of get situated, I actually had to come out in Australia. There wasn't even enough room in the United States for me. So, I was in Australia, and I met somebody, and that's how I came out. New York was like a small town here. As a matter of fact, at one point, I think, when I came back from my Australia trip, someone took me to a gay bar on 72nd Street, and 2 days later, my parents received some sort of an anonymous typewritten letter that I was going into gay bars, and it was trying for me. It was very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And in what way did you come out in Australia? Was it during an interview or what?
No, somebody brought me out. I had a relationship for the first time.
I see. Huh. And how was that for you? Because most of your songs focused on boy-girl melodrama. When you knew that you were a lesbian, did that change how you related to the public in regard to these songs? No.
That's ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
Those were songs that meant something to me, you know, for what they were, those songs.
Uh-huh. And most recently, you've hosted the PBS series In the Life, and I think that's great. The LGBT community, as you've said, still needs positive role models. Well, what has that experience been for you?
Oh, my God. You know, my philosophy in life, Tish, is everything is good and bad. There's nothing you can do that doesn't have good and bad repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, coming out in public, it doesn't necessarily make life easier. It often makes it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I did what I felt I had to do. I got to live with myself, and I got to walk with my chin up. And if people have a problem with it, I'm deeply sorry, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. And so you have gotten some hate mail and had some problems with it, I assume.
You know, there's always a faction that's going to take it too far.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether they be gay and lesbian or whether they be conservatives. You're never going to please all the people all the time.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, there's a point in your life, in mine right now, I turn 60, I'm not about to try to please anybody but myself right
that's
now.
That's great. Leslie, I love that. I love that. Yeah.
What's it all about? I thought about turning 60, and I was upset about it, and I said, this is 60, this is an age, and I finally said to myself, you know what? Forget about it. You got, you're 60, and every day should be different and should be new, and you're going to take on new projects, and that's what's going to keep you going, not thinking about when you were 50 or 40 or 16 in my case, but going ahead and doing new things.
Yeah, that's a terrific, terrific way of looking at life. Do you think you'll ever write songs that are explicitly directed toward the LGBT community?
You know, it's so fascinating that you would say that, because I was doing an interview with a gentleman, I can't remember his name. He was out at the L.A. Gay Center, and it was for not Air America. It was for, maybe it was Air America.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it was Air America, but it was an out Q show. And he said, how about writing for the community? And, you know, I've never specifically thought about that, because I always think of myself as part of the greater world. I don't think of myself as a little slice of pie.
Right.
But of course, it's reasonable, and it should be done. I mean, there are times, think about the lyric to Out Here on My Own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it may not have specifically come out of that scene in the film when the lyric came to me, but it's certainly in my playing the song over the years, sitting down at the piano and thinking about it. Some of those lyrics definitely portray those feelings.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you mean by not wanting to be in a box, too, because I've talked to Janice Ian, and I've talked to Holly Near and Chris Williamson and all those feminist-associated singers, and they don't want to be in a box either.
Well, you know,
and for a time it was probably...
I was out at in San Francisco recently, and at the Brava Theater, which is just an absolutely incredible theater, run by women, mostly trying to put on women's projects, and Kate Clinton had been there.
Ah.
Just a couple of weeks before, and she had been invited to a dinner that they were throwing for me after the concert, and she couldn't make it, but she did send a little message back that she thought maybe she and I could be on be the next ticket in 2008, another Clinton Gore ticket.
That's great.
I thought it was kind of clever.
That is.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, I was going to ask you about that. You did venture into politics at times. You served as
chair
for the...
I have. God knows I've my heart has gone there. When I was a sophomore or a freshman, when I started Sarah Lawrence in my freshman or sophomore year, Robert Kennedy was running for senator,
mm-hmm.
and he completely stole my heart. And I started working for him and did many concerts around the country for him with Bobby Darin, as a matter of fact. He always used to send us in, and we would be the entertainment, and he'd show up in a helicopter at the last minute and run out on stage. It was really exciting.
Wow.
And, of course, you know, my heart got broken, first with his brother and then with him. So I stayed away from politics for a little while. I did join Hubert Humphrey on the campaign trail at one point. I enjoyed him very much. And I worked a little for Bill Clinton. So I've stayed in there a bit. Most of my work right now goes into women's organizations. I'm working with Faye Waddleton for the Center for Gender, which is all about getting information out about women and their needs and helping organizations. And I've decided also, one of my decisions at 60, I do so much work in so many areas, I'm going to pull it all together and concentrate on one thing. And for me now, it's going to be the Center for Gender, because there's not enough information known about the health of women and our specific problems. And that's what Faye Waddleton and her group are doing.
That's terrific. I love hearing that. I also know that you were really good friends with Bella Abzug. Did she influence you greatly?
Oh, my God. Yes, she really did, because there was a woman who took it from nobody.
Yes, I know.
Just, you know, I mean, as abrasive and as difficult as she could be, man, she took it from nobody, and she would teach you to stand up. And, you know, in a funny way, I mean, Bella never told me to come out and be gay, but Bella helped me stand on my own two feet and feel proud of who I am, and it was a result of Bella's mentoring. Now, again, she never said, get out there and, you know, give it to him, but she helped me understand what my job was.
Yeah, I actually had the rare opportunity of meeting her once at a NOW conference, and I thought she had such fabulous presence. It was almost radiating.
It was radiating, yeah. And I got an opportunity to spend what I'd call downtime with Bella when she was at her house out in the Hamptons and was swimming in the swimming pool. She was never happier than then, or when we were grilling outside or just relaxing. And she had such an incredible sense of humor, and she was just a joy to be around. And I must say, as a matter of fact, we just started an organization called the Bella Abzug Leadership Institute through Hunter College, where women are being trained to get up and be more like Bella, and teach them what's important and how to conquer those fears of getting up and talking in front of people and getting out there and embracing them. Because if there was one thing that Bella could do, boy, when she stood up to make a speech, she might have started quietly, but she always ended with fireworks.
I know.
Man.
She was amazing.
Amazing.
In 1980, you mentioned the song Out Here on My Own. You wrote that song with your brother for the movie Fame.
That's correct.
And this is another song on your new CD, which you had never recorded before.
That's right.
Let's listen to a bit of that.
Sure.
Sometimes I wonder where I've been, who I am, do I fit in, make believe in, is hard alone, out here on my guide me far and shine me home out here on my own. When I'm down and feeling blue, I close my eyes so I can be with you.
Now, this is a great version, Leslie. I love it.
Thank you.
And I didn't even realize that you had written this until I got the new CD.
Sure, understood.
Yeah.
Most people don't. I do it I also do it in concert, and I tend to do it just at the piano by myself, and it's very effective.
Mm-hmm. How was it collaborating with your brother, and will you be doing that again?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Michael and I really were each other's first collaborators, because when we were kids, that's pretty much how we spent the afternoons or the evenings after dinner, just hanging around the piano, either writing songs or making arrangements of old songs or doing, you know, that's how we spent our time.
Hmm.
So we early on started writing songs together, and in fact, we've just written a song called Higher Ground for an animated feature that he's in the process of helping David Seltzer put together. It's a really cute idea. And he does call upon me to do some lyrics for him every now and again, and I call upon him to do some music for me every now and again.
Oh, that's great. What a nice thing to be able to collaborate with your brother. That's wonderful.
It's like it's like getting on a bicycle. We have a really great time. There's nothing more fun than when I'm actually working on a song with Michael. It usually takes about 3 days of absolute concentration. And we do go through, maybe, you know, we'll have, by the time I'll have 40 or 50 different lyric choices. But it's always challenging, and it's always fun, and it always feels like we're sort of riding on a cloud we've been on before.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Listen, I know you've also said that the record industry has always been and still is sexist and homophobic, and that's why you've chosen to work with an independent label. Talk to me a little about that.
Well, it's not the only reason I chose to work with an independent label.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, most of the majors are sort of out of business anyway, and because of the digital age, I was able to actually do an album and bring it in for under $25,000. That same album, if I had done it for Capitol or J Records, would have cost me probably $175,000. And there was no J Records or Capitol Records that was going to put $175,000 into a 60-year-old Leslie Gore plus advertising. You know, you're laughing, but that's the truth.
I understand, yeah.
And
but I think
so
they're dead wrong.
So there I was faced with, is there another way to do this? And in a funny way, this whole digi thing and the independent label, it's like going back to the grassroots concept of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You go up and you do a concert, and then you sell 40 or 60 or 100 albums, and they tell 20 of their friends, and before you know it, you got a buzz going.
Mm-hmm. And you also get to pick your own musicians and so on, right? And you don't have studio bosses breathing down your back.
That's true, too.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to say, working with Quincy in the early years, he gave me a tremendous amount of latitude. I always felt a part of the team.
Mm-hmm.
He never said, you're going to sing this in this key and that's that. He was much more savvy than that, and a terrific guy as a result.
Hmm. And what made you decide to record a new CD anyway? I know you've stayed in the limelight in some fashion,
yeah.
but now it looks like you're trying to resurrect a real career and going on tour and.
You know, there's never been a reason to resurrect. There's always been opportunities that I could take advantage of. The 70s may not have been so lucrative, but by the 80s, people were beginning to look at the music of the 60s with a nicer eye, perhaps. They had a kinship for it. And for the next 15, 20 years, there was a number of oldie shows. And I think sort of what's happened is, because there were so many oldie shows, some of those have gotten kind of tired. And now we're into 70s, 80s, 90s music. So the music of the 50s, 60s is not as prevalent. And I felt sort of stymied, like there wasn't, like, why should I just sing those songs when there's so much out there to sing, songs that have already been written and songs that need to be written. So I just didn't want to stop. I wanted to incorporate those songs, honor them, and go on and do new things as well.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of your influences? I know you've mentioned Billie Holiday, haven't you?
My little puppy is named after Billie Holiday.
Ah, really?
Absolutely. She's a 3-year-old Cocker Spaniel, and she's named after Billie. I listened to a lot of Dinah Washington,
mm-hmm.
a lot of Lena Horne, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald. These were, I mean, it was also partially the music that my parents played around the house, but let's face it, you know, these were some of the greatest female interpreters of song that existed.
Oh, absolutely.
Then when I got a little bit older, I found people like Anita O'Day and mm-hmm. June Christie, just slightly, and Carmen McRae, just slightly under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And I became interested in those ladies. And then I began getting interested in composers from other countries like Jacques Brel and Charles Aznavour. And it was just sort of a journey that I took through music that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've mentioned that you had no women role models when you began your career in the early and mid-60s. Have you gone out of your way to help young women and be a role model?
I don't think I've gone out of my way, but every now and again someone comes through your life and, you know, you're just thrown into a situation and you know that's a person that you're going to help.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's a person you're going to mentor, or that's a person you're just going to encourage, whatever that may be. And I think that happens to all of us. You just, there's something, you see something in someone. That happens to me with singers. It happens to me with young comics. I met a young woman at, I did an evening with Anthony DeCurtis at the 92nd Street Y a couple of months ago, and this unusual looking woman came through the rope line, and I don't know, our eyes connected, and something happened, and I come to find out she's a comic and a kind of a cutting edge kind of a gal too, and she's gay, and she's got this interesting show going on now. So I'm just gathering some people together to go over and see her, because I'm sure she's got to be terrific. You know, it's just, it's looking for the next thing. It's seeing what's going on, and I love seeing what's happening with the newer generations as well. Because my, you know, most of my friends are still doing the same old shit, to be honest with you. And you know, onward and upward. You know, you're not dead yet.
That's right, and I've heard Joan Baez say the same thing, that she's really interested in what the younger generation is doing, and has even collaborated on a couple of CDs with some younger singers.
Well, that was also part of the intent with the Ever Since album. Blake and all of who produced the album, and all the musicians are all in their 30s. It was kind of a Rick Rubin, Jack White kind of attempt at intergenerational music, and this is the band that actually travels with me now, and I got to tell you, They're kicking my butt, you know. They're keeping me working.
I'll bet.
Well, so it's really wonderful. I love to sit down with them after a show and hear what's going on in their heads. It really it keeps you in touch and it keeps you young. I think it's important for us fogies to stay in touch.
you do not sound like a fogey to me. Well, what are you working on now? You have thrown some new songs together and going to have a new CD soon?
I'm still, this CD, I know it sort of came out the end of June last year,
mm-hmm.
but we've only begun to release it in certain parts of the country. We'll be headed to the Philadelphia, Washington, Baltimore area over the summer. There are parts of the country that still haven't really heard this record and we haven't gotten to it yet. What I would like to do within the next year or so is record a live album. So that I have some of these songs from the album as well as the classics in their new, not new, but in their button-down way,
mm-hmm.
in their defrocked way, unzipped, if you will, because I think the songs sound incredible, and I think it gives kind of a, I don't know, it takes you back, but it takes you forward as well.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how to describe it any other way, but you do get this, you know these songs, you know you've heard them, you know what you're listening to, and yet they sound fresh.
We are almost out of time. Can you give your website so people can order the CD if they'd like?
Sure. LeslieGore.com puts you right in touch with Engine Company Records. So go to LeslieGore.com, and any information you want on me, except where my new tattoo is, will be there.
Leslie Gore, thank you so much for being with us. This has been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Tish. I appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.